Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, I'd like to inform all participants that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All lines have been placed in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. Please make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name clearly when prompted. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Jackie Glaze. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon and welcome, everyone, to today's Allstate Call-In webinar. I'll now turn to Dan Tsai, our Center Director, for opening remarks. Dan?
Thanks, Jackie. Good afternoon, everybody. We have a few topics today, and I just wanted to open up with Anne-Marie. We'll walk through a summary of them shortly. But one topic we will be going through today is monkeypox, and more details from a Medicaid coverage and benefit standpoint. It's very salient given we've had quite a number of questions from states around this topic and from others in the community. I just got another question from a state earlier today, and so the team has spent quite a bit of time trying to make sure we can help answer questions and outline what the coverage and other framework for that is. It's certainly a very, very important, salient topic. A second piece that the team will go through, and Anne-Marie will talk, and the team will talk more about, is the eligibility and enrollment, streamlining eligibility and enrollment notice of proposed rulemaking that we released just the other week. We're quite excited about it relative to advancing many important operational and policy pieces for supporting coverage and streamlining and modernizing parts of eligibility and enrollment. Hopefully some of the policies will be very clearly sensible as we think about making the experience much easier for potential enrollees and enrollees. And we are very eager for public comment, particularly as we think about a range of operational and other considerations. So the team is looking forward to walking through that, and there's some other pieces as well. But I wanted to note those two pieces to say thank you to everybody, as usual, for what consistently feels like a huge amount of work, some days with lots of progress, some days with more frustration than others. And I think I and some others will be seeing a range of states at NASHP today and tomorrow, so we are looking forward to that as well. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Anne-Marie. Thank you all.
Thanks, Dan, and hi, everyone. Welcome to today's Allstate call, and thanks for joining us. As Dan mentioned, first up today, we have Sarah Harshman from our Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group, who will provide an update on monkeypox. And I think, as Dan said, you'll see some incredibly important information that we know that states have been waiting for. Then a number of our subject matter experts, including Stephanie Bell, Shannon Lovejoy, Emily King, Melissa Height, and Jean Coffey, will provide a walkthrough of the new eligibility and enrollment notice of proposed rulemaking that CMS released on August 31st. Finally, we'll open the lines for your questions. We'll use the webinar for today's presentations, so if you're not logged into the webinar platform, I suggest you do so now. But before we jump in, I wanted to provide a clarification from our team that works on Section 9817 of the American Rescue Plan. Previously, we had indicated that if your state is reducing or eliminating a waiting list for Section 1915C waiver program as part of the state's activities to enhance, expand, or strengthen home and community-based services, or HCBS, under the American Rescue Plan, Section 9817, the state cannot use the funds attributable to the increased FMAP to pay for approved capacity as of April 1st, 2021. Approved capacity refers to currently unused waiver slots up to the ceiling described in the CMS-approved waiver application. Instead, we had indicated that the state must increase the number of waiver slots beyond currently approved levels and could only use the funds attributable to the increased FMAP to pay for services for individuals who are newly enrolled in the waiver program directly as a result of the increase in the number of slots. Since that time, we've received inquiries from several states that had imposed off-the-books or unknown waiting lists prior to April 1st, 2021, based on the amount of funding approved in their state budget, even though the state had not filled all available slots reflected in the approved 1915C waiver. Based on these inquiries, we have reconsidered our policy, and we're now advising that under certain conditions, CMS may provide the use, may approve the use of the funds attributable to the increased federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, under Section 9817 to address these waiting lists. We will be providing, if you didn't follow all of that, which I can more than understand, we'll be providing additional information at this, at the National ARP Section 9817 Technical Assistance Webinar on September 22nd. And as always, CMS is available to provide technical assistance. If you have any questions about this, you can also contact us at our mailbox at HCBS, increased FMAP, at cms.hhs.gov. With that, I'll turn things over to Sarah Hushman to start our monkeypox update. Sarah?
Great. Thank you, Anne-Marie. And hello, everybody. As mentioned, my name is Sarah Hushman, and I'm the technical director with the CMCS Division of Benefits and Coverage. As Dan and Anne-Marie mentioned, we received a number of questions from states on the monkeypox, or MPX, response that we hope to address with this presentation. As a heads up, I will be using the MPX acronym to refer to the monkeypox virus moving forward. On August 4th, 2022, Secretary Becerra declared the MPX public health emergency. Since that declaration, we have received questions from states and other stakeholders on what waivers and flexibilities are now available with the public health emergency declaration. At this time, since President Biden has not declared a national emergency or disaster under the Stafford Act or the National Emergencies Act, CMS is unable to grant Section 1135 waivers as we have with the COVID public health emergency. Existing flexibilities remain available, including 1915 waiver programs and state plan amendments, but states will have to follow normal federal requirements, such as tribal consultation and public notice. I'd also like to note that for Medicaid, the temporary 6.2 percentage point increase in FMAP, generally applicable to expenditures during the COVID-19 public health emergency, is available until the end of the quarter in which the COVID-19 public health emergency ends, provided that the state continues to meet the conditions for receiving that FMAP increase. And we can go to the next slide, please. In Medicaid, MPX testing is covered under the mandatory lab and X-ray services benefit. And since there is a public health emergency declaration made by the Secretary, states can employ additional flexibilities to open additional locations in which a lab test may be administered and to waive requirements that the test must be ordered by a physician or other licensed practitioner. While there are flexibilities around the administration of the test, testing must still be furnished by a CLIA-certified laboratory. In CHIP, testing can be covered under the optional laboratory and X-ray services benefit. And next slide, please. All right, now on to coverage of MPX vaccinations. Currently, the ACIP only recommends vaccination for certain healthcare workers who are at a high risk of exposure. In Medicaid, there is currently only mandatory coverage of child vaccinations that are included on ACIP's child vaccine schedule. As it stands, MPX vaccinations are not a part of the child or adult vaccine schedule. As a result, coverage of vaccinations for children eligible for EPSDT hinges on whether a vaccination is deemed medically necessary by the state. According to regulation, states must provide all 1905A services that are determined to be medically necessary for the beneficiary based on an individualized assessment and medical necessity criteria. Our regulations don't prescribe what states must include in medical necessity assessments, so each state will be responsible to create their own criteria. We encourage states to look to current ACIP recommendation criteria as the basis for meeting medical necessity and to also consider other factors such as exposure to the MPX virus. Outside of the EPSDT population, states have the option to provide vaccination coverage. Additionally, states who have opted to receive an extra 1 percentage point of federal match for covering ACIP recommended adults as provided in the ACA would be required to provide the MPX vaccination to those who meet the criteria set by the ACIP recommendation. This coverage is required as our regulations point to mandatory coverage of ACIP recommended vaccines as opposed to coverage for ACIP recommended vaccines on the child or adult vaccine schedule. All right, next slide, please. CHIP coverage is a little more straightforward than Medicaid and is mandatory for individuals for whom the ACIP recommends the vaccination, and for all others, coverage is optional. Given the especially narrow ACIP recommendation for MPX and the demographics of the CHIP population, we expect this CHIP coverage mandate to apply to an exceedingly small number of people, if any at all. We would also like to note that at this time, the JYNNEOS vaccine is the preferred MPX vaccine and is being federally purchased by the U.S. government. Through the CDC provider agreement, no individual may be charged for the vaccine. However, an individual may be charged a fee for the administration of the vaccine. I should also note the MPX vaccine cannot be withheld if an individual does not have the means to pay for the administration fee. All right, next slide, please. Again, as I mentioned on the last slide, the MPX vaccine is being federally purchased and therefore distributed at no cost to states and providers. Therefore, this information applies to vaccine administration. In regards to the benefit category states can use to cover vaccination services, vaccine administration can be covered under the Medicaid Preventative Services benefit and may also be covered under other benefits such as physician services and other licensed practitioner services. Another reminder that standalone vaccine counseling is required for vaccinations covered under EPSDT, and this could include MPX vaccinations. Next slide, please. There is no specific treatment for MPX approved by the FDA, but there are other FDA-approved antivirals developed for use in patients with smallpox that may prove beneficial against MPX. Many of these drugs are available through the Strategic National Stockpile for free, which is operated by the federal government. In the case a drug is not supplied by the Strategic National Stockpile, we've provided some background on the slide to help states determine appropriate coverage and whether FSP and the Medicaid drug rebates might be applicable. Some of these drugs may be covered outpatient drugs under the Medicaid drug rebate program, but it will depend on the setting in which the drug is administered, whether the drug is being used for a medically accepted indication, and whether the manufacturer participates in the Medicaid drug rebate program. If a drug does not meet the definition of a covered outpatient drug, states have the option to cover the drug as a prescribed drug. FSP would be available for this, but not Medicaid manufacturer rebates. We understand that Medicaid coverage of therapies for MPX isn't completely straightforward, and CMS is available to provide any technical assistance needed. In CHIP, states have the option to cover MPX antivirals. Next slide, please. States have the ability to impose nominal cost sharing for vaccinations, testing, and treatment unless an exemption applies. Cost sharing is never required, and we encourage states to remove or reduce cost sharing under the state plan. Groups that must be exempted from Medicaid cost sharing must include most children under 18, American Indians, Alaska Natives, and other populations described in regulation. American Indians, Alaska Natives must be exempted from cost sharing under CHIP as well. Certain services must be exempted from Medicaid cost sharing, including emergency services, preventive services provided to children, and pregnancy-related services. Medicaid and CHIP premiums and cost sharing are subject to an aggregate limit of 5% of family income. And next slide, please. And this slide provides some examples of the maximum cost sharing allowed based on a beneficiary's income. As a reminder, these slides will be available on Medicaid.gov after the presentation for further reference. Medicaid cost sharing for vaccination, treatment, and testing services must generally be below $5 for beneficiaries below the poverty line and no greater than 10 to 20% of the cost the agency pays for higher-income individuals. In CHIP, cost-sharing for beneficiaries under 150% generally cannot exceed the nominal amounts permitted in Medicaid. Next slide, please. With all that, we encourage states to evaluate their current coverage, cost-sharing, and reimbursement rates in their state plans to make sure they have sufficient coverage of MTX testing, vaccinations, and treatments. State plan amendments will be needed if a state wants to reduce cost-sharing or increase reimbursement rates. We also encourage states to contact CMS to determine if a spot is needed to expand coverage to include testing or vaccination. Next slide, please. We've also received questions from states as to what codes and reimbursement Medicare is using for MTX vaccination and testing. As mentioned on our last All-State call, Medicare will be using the generic vaccine administration codes 90460 and 90471 for MTX vaccine administration. The payment for these codes is generally $17, depending on the setting, plus a geographic adjustment. And again, Medicare is not planning to release MTX-specific vaccine administration codes. For testing, there is a new AMA CPT code to describe testing for MTX, which is 87593. Currently, local Medicare administrative contractors develop the payment amounts for the new test codes in their respective jurisdictions until Medicare establishes a national payment rate on the clinical laboratory fee schedule. And with that, that concludes my overview, and I will turn it over to Jackie Glaze to introduce the next speakers.
Thank you, Sarah, for your presentation. Next, we'll turn over to our team that will provide a walkthrough of the new eligibility and enrollment in PRM that was recently released. So I'll turn now to you, Stephanie Bell, to start that discussion.
Thanks, Jackie. Hi, everyone. This is Stephanie Bell. I'm a senior policy advisor in the Children and Adult Health Programs Group. And I am very excited to be back today to share more detailed information about the NPRM. I'm going to start off with just a tiny bit of context, and I'm going to go quickly so we can leave most of the time for an overview by my colleagues on the specific provisions. And then we'll circle back to a few words about implementation. Next slide. So as you can see, and hopefully already knew, the NPRM was officially published on September 7th, 2022, and comments are can be submitted through November 7th. Next slide. As we started to work on this NPRM, there were a number of factors that were front and center on our minds, and among these were the presidential directives that were executive orders issued by President Biden on strengthening Medicaid and CHIP with the idea of making high-quality health care accessible to every American. The Affordable Care Act accomplishments that have been so effective at streamlining eligibility and enrollment processes, but were really focused on the MAGI-based population, so they weren't available to all Medicaid beneficiaries. Next slide. The declines in enrollment that we started seeing prior to the public health emergency, particularly among children. And finally, the unnecessarily high rate of improper payments that was specifically related to insufficient documentation. Next slide. So, thinking about those things, we came up with a set of provisions that we're going to talk about today in these four buckets. And I'm going to go ahead and jump right into the first one, streamlining application and enrollment processes. Next slide. I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Height to start the overview.
Thanks, Steph. My name is Melissa Height, and I'm a technical director with the Medicare-Medicaid Coordination Office, and I'm presenting some provisions related to dual-eligible individuals. Overall, these proposals are designed to streamline and increase enrollment in the Medicare Savings Programs, or MSPs, which make Medicare coverage more accessible and affordable. It also means people have more available money for food, rent, transportation, and other life necessities. The first proposal would streamline enrollment for individuals in a Medicare Part D low income subsidy program, LIS, or extra help into the MSPs. Most individuals eligible for LIS meet the eligibility requirements for an MSP eligibility group, but over 1 million LIS recipients are not enrolled in the MSPs. The proposal codifies the statutory requirement that states initiate MSP applications using LIS application data or lead data. Currently, the Social Security Administration transmits data from LIS applications to Medicaid agencies, and then states use that data to create an MSP application and determine eligibility. In order to maximize the use of lead data and minimize burden on individuals, we encourage states to adopt targeted income and resource disregards, fully align LIS and MSP financial methodologies. Some areas of misalignment include dividend interest and income, value of non-liquid resources, burial funds, and cash value of life insurance. Next slide, please. Our proposal would require states to accept SSA's verified findings and deem full subsidy LIS recipients as eligible for MSPs. The income, resource, and methodologies are aligned, and also accept self-attestation of income and resources not counted in determining LIS eligibility, with an option to conduct post-enrollment verification. The second proposal would also further align LIS and MSP financial methodology by defining family size MSPs to be no less than the LIS definition, which is generally the applicant's spouse, and certain other financially dependent relatives living in the same household. Next slide, please. The third proposal would reduce administrative burden for both states and individuals and simplify enrollment in MSPs by automatically enrolling most individuals receiving SSI in the Quimby MSP eligibility group. Individuals who meet the income and resource requirements for SSI are always financially eligible for the Quimby eligibility group. Preliminary CMS data indicates that about 500,000 Medicare-eligible SSI beneficiaries are not enrolled in Quimby, and thus are going without this important health and economic benefit. There is an exception to this automatic deeming of SSI into Quimby. It's optional for states who do not have a Part A buy-in agreement with CMS, also known as group payer states. Next slide. The fourth proposal aims to provide individuals with protection from Medicare premiums and cost sharing at the earliest time. Current rules prevent individuals who miss their Medicare initial enrollment period and who reside in these group payer states from enrolling in Part A until the general enrollment period, GEP, which takes place every January through March. If you enroll in Part A during the GEP, Quimby coverage starts July 1st. Starting in January 2023, however, under the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, for those who enroll during the GEP, Part A will begin much earlier, the first day of the month following the month in which they enroll. This proposal permits states to start Quimby coverage as early as the month after conditional Part A enrollment. This concludes the discussion on the duals-related provisions in NPRM. I'm now going to turn over the presentation to my colleague in CMCS and one of my personal favorite speakers, Jean Coffey, to discuss a proposal to facilitate enrollment of medically needy individuals.
Okay. Can everybody hear me? This is Jean Coffey from the Division of Medicaid Eligibility Policy. Can you hear me, Melissa?
We can hear you.
Oh, okay. All right, good. Well, thank you, Melissa. And, yes, Melissa is a former colleague of mine in Division of Medicaid Eligibility Policy. So I'm going to tackle the next few slides as quickly as I can, although at least the medically needy discussion is a little bit meaty, so I'm going to spend a little bit of disproportionate time on them or on this particular proposal. And so let me just get into it. All right, to level set, the medically needy. These are generally individuals who would otherwise be eligible for Medicaid but for their income and who attain Medicaid eligibility by meeting what's called a spend out. And a spend down is that practice by which an individual reduces his or her accountable income to the medically needy income level by the amount of medical debt they're liable for and for which they do not have any other insurance. And where an individual establishes that sufficient debt, they're Medicaid eligible, but only until the end of their budget period, which can't be any longer than 6 months under our regulations. And the fact is that the medically needy eligibility determination really isn't easy for anybody, either the individual themselves or the state. And that's because the process entails this constant herding and submission of bills to the state agency by the individual and the frequent income calculations by the state agency. Well, many years ago, we decided through regulations that we would address this challenge for states and certain medically needy individuals, and specifically institutionalized individuals. What we told states, again, through regulation, current regulations, is that they could project the institutional expenses at the beginning of a budget period. In other words, they could assume that the institutionalized individuals would incur the expenses in the budget period, and the states could make eligibility effective at the beginning of the budget period, where the individual's projected institutional expenses are at least equal to their spend out. So in a state that elects this authority, an institutionalized individual doesn't have to constantly submit medical bills to the state, and the state avoids having to do multiple income calculations. But we've concluded that this authority shouldn't be limited to institutionalized individuals. And what we're proposing here is that states have the additional option to let prospective medically needy individuals project their non-institutional expenses. Next slide, please. All right, and here, let's see, here is how it could work. You know, we have an example here of, and I'm actually looking at one of our original iterations of this slide deck, so hopefully it matches what you guys are all looking at right now. We have an individual with $1,200 in monthly income. The state's medically needy income level is $700. The difference there is $500. The state has a budget period of 3 months, so what the state does is it multiplies that $500 by 3 months, and it comes out to $1,500. This is what the individual has to incur to meet their spend down. Under the current rules, the individual is only going to become Medicaid eligible during this 3 month budget period when the individual submits to the state agency the relevant documentation establishing that $1,500 in medical debt that the individual doesn't have any insurance for. And typically, the state goes about verifying that the individual has this debt and that the individual doesn't have that other insurance. And it may be possible that the individual only establishes this $1,500 in debt near the end of the 3 months, which means that up until that point during this 3 month budget period, the individual doesn't have Medicaid eligibility at all, and the individual's Medicaid eligibility ends at the end of this 3 months, and then the process begins all over again during the next 3 months. Well, if the individual's services are such that they are reasonably constant and predictable, like, for example, the medications in an individual's pharmacy profile or the services in the individual's plan of care authorized under one of the various 1915C authorities, we are proposing that states would be allowed to project that individual's expenses, those non-institutional expenses, so that, excuse me, the individual would be eligible at the beginning of the budget period. The individual would not have to submit bills during the budget period. The state would not have to do multiple income calculations, and the individual would not have any gaps in coverage. We think that this is really important authority, as I think the previous slide indicated. We think that certainly for those individuals who are receiving services under 1915C authorities, this would really facilitate access to non-institutional services and help rebalance Medicaid. And we think that it would be administratively convenient for states. I do want to point out that this authority, we would also allow 209B states to adopt. You know, so in 209B states, for the mandatory ABD eligibility group, they do have to permit the deduction of incurred medical expenses. They can project for those mandatory ABD eligibility groups. They can project institutional expenses. We would permit them project these non-institutional expenses. If, you know, again, these are the ones, the pharmacy profiles, the C, I, or K, or J services, they're the ones that we have identified in the preamble as being possibilities for this projection. We do invite comment on potentially other examples. All right, next slide, please. Okay, reasonable compatibility. let me just take a sip of water here. All right. As many of you know, our regulations identify a number of sources that states must attempt to obtain eligibility-relevant information from in determining eligibility. And our regulations also require that where the info gathered from these sources is reasonably compatible with the info a Medicaid applicant has provided, states cannot require additional information from the individual. Well, we've gotten some input that the application of the rule to resource-related eligibility determinations, you know, where an individual is subject to a resource test for their eligibility, that the application of the reasonable compatibility rule has not been clear. In other words, some believe that it has not applied in the context of resource eligibility determinations. And so we are proposing here to confirm, to make it clear, that the reasonable compatibility rule applies to resource-related eligibility determinations. So, for example, where the resource information an individual has provided to the state agency is reasonably compatible with the info the state has received for the individual from the state's asset verification system, no additional information would be required of the individual. That's, you know, just one particular example. Next slide, please. Verification of citizenship. All right, now, complementing our regulations on the citizenship-related requirements for Medicaid and CHIP is our regulation at 405/407 that identifies the methods by which status for Medicaid or CHIP should be verified. And in this regulation, in paragraph A, there is listed what is referred to as the standalone sources of evidence, meaning that nothing else may be required where one of these pieces of evidence is confirmed, including but not limited to, you know, citing straight from the regulation of a U.S. passport or certification naturalization or a state-issued driver's license that meets certain requirements. Well, we're proposing to add to this list in 435-407A. Specifically, where an individual's citizenship can be confirmed with a state's Vital Statistics Agency or the U.S. Department of Homeland Security SAVE program, nothing else would be required. You know, currently where a state verifies citizenship through these two sources, a state must also have the individual offer proof of his or her identity. But again, we're proposing here that a state Vital Statistics Agency verification or DHS SAVE program verification would also be standalone verifications and joining those others that are listed in 435-407A. All right, next slide, please. Finally, we have these two elements. Let's see, we have the requirement to apply for other benefits and the optional limitation on the number of reasonable opportunity periods. With the requirement to apply for other benefits, this is a very old historical rule. Dating back to the 1970s, it is not one that is statutorily required. You know, we adopted back in the 1970s this rule because at the time, the predominant other cash assistance programs, federal programs, had the same rule, you know, one of which, of course, still exists and still applies this rule, the SSI program, but the other, of course, is the APC program. It is now obsolete. But again, we adopted that approach but in our regulations at 435-608, but we've reconsidered it. You know, we think that oftentimes this non-statutorily required rule can present a barrier to fast Medicaid eligibility determinations, that on occasion the application for other benefits would be no use to an individual because they may be seeking eligibility in an eligibility group for which no income test is applied, or under the methodology, the financial methodology that's applied to their income or financial eligibility determination, any such other benefits would be irrelevant to such eligibility determination. So what we're proposing is to eliminate the rule entirely. Now, we are asking for feedback, you know, for from, yes,
I have to cut you off now.
Okay. All right. So I'm sorry. I will be around for other questions. I'm sorry I didn't get to the reasonable opportunity period elimination of the limitation. But, yes, I will turn it back to you, Stephanie, to go to our next speaker.
Thank you. Can we jump ahead? One more, and then we're going to turn it over to Shannon.
Thanks. So this is Shannon, and I will kick off our discussion on our next objective related to making sure that eligible individuals enrolled in Medicaid and SHIP can retain coverage at and in between renewals. So one way we propose to achieve continuity of coverage is by aligning MAGI and non-MAGI application and renewal requirements. Currently, states may not require an in-person interview at application and renewal for beneficiaries. They must renew eligibility for MAGI beneficiaries only once every 12 months, and for MAGI beneficiaries, when a renewal cannot be completed based on available information, states must provide the individual a pre-populated renewal form, a minimum of 30 days to return that pre-populated form, and a 90-day reconsideration period in which the state must reconsider eligibility without requiring a new application if the individual lost coverage for failure to return their renewal form but subsequently returns that form. States may currently apply these policies but are not required to do so for non-MAGI beneficiaries. And in the proposed rule, we propose to facilitate continued enrollment of eligible individuals by requiring these policies be applied to all beneficiaries, including non-MAGI beneficiaries. Next slide, please. We also propose to address processes for states to act on changes in circumstances. While states must redetermine eligibility in between renewals whenever a beneficiary experiences a change in circumstances, the current regulations do not specify the expectations for processing these redeterminations. So to support timely processing of redeterminations and improve coverage retention, we propose to codify the steps that states must take to act on changes in circumstances for all beneficiaries. In addition to outlining the processes that states must take, we also propose that all beneficiaries be provided a minimum of 30 days to respond to any requests for information needed to redetermine eligibility following a change in circumstances. And we also propose to ensure that beneficiaries are provided a duration period, similar to what's currently provided for MAGI beneficiaries at renewal, if an individual loses coverage for not responding to a request for information, but subsequently returns that information. Next slide, please. We also propose actions for states when beneficiary addresses may have changed. So states often obtain that a beneficiary's address may have changed or the state receives returned mail, but the current regulations do not explain the steps that must be taken to verify and update a change in address. So in order to promote continuity of coverage and reduce procedural terminations, we are proposing to specify in regulations that the steps that states must take when beneficiary mail is returned or when the state obtains information indicating a potential address change. And this includes requiring states to conduct outreach by mail and other modalities to try to locate a beneficiary. This also includes specifying the steps that states must take if they are still unable to locate the individual, depending on whether the state has information that indicates a change of address that's in-state or out-of-state, or when a beneficiary's whereabouts have become unknown. Next slide, please. And I will now turn the conversation over to my colleague, Emily King.
Thanks, Shannon. My name is Emily King with the Division of State Coverage Programs. I'm going to discuss transitions between Medicaid and CHIP, and then access barriers we are removing in CHIP for children through this rule. So first step is facilitating transitions between Medicaid and CHIP. Under the existing framework, some states have been transferring beneficiaries between Medicaid and CHIP when potentially eligible for the other program. In addition, some states have been terminating coverage when there is a change in eligibility and the beneficiary has not confirmed or denied the change. To facilitate transitions between Medicaid and CHIP and to prevent gaps in coverage for eligible children, we propose to require state Medicaid agencies to make determinations of eligibility for separate CHIP, and then for CHIP agencies to make eligibility determinations for Medicaid. As a part of this requirement, we propose for each agency to transition eligible individuals to the other agency and accept eligibility determinations made by the other agency. Under the proposed rule, the agencies will issue a single combined notice of eligibility to families, which includes details about the program the individual is ineligible for, as well as information about the program that the individual is eligible for. Next slide, please. And next, I'll talk about three access barriers we are removing in CHIP. And the first in this category is eliminating CHIP waiting periods. Currently, states may impose up to a 90-day waiting period prior to a child enrolling in CHIP if a family previously had group coverage. To improve access to care and remove coverage gaps for eligible kids, we are proposing to eliminate the option for states to implement waiting periods as a strategy to prevent substitution of group coverage in CHIP. This change would bring CHIP into alignment with requirements in Medicaid and individual market exchange plans. States will still need to have a strategy in place to prevent substitution of coverage, such as data verification with other sources to see if applicants have access to other sources of coverage. Notably, we're also seeking comments on an option to permit states to impose a 30-day waiting period if states are able to demonstrate that high rates of substitution are a problem. Next slide, please. Next up is that we are proposing to remove premium lockout periods in CHIP. Currently, states are permitted to apply a premium lockout period for up to 90 days to prevent children in CHIP from enrolling in coverage if they have unpaid premiums or enrollment fees. We are proposing to remove premium lockouts and suggest states consider other mechanisms for addressing timely payment of premiums, a few examples of which are listed on the slide here. Removing lockouts will improve continuity of care and more closely align CHIP and Medicaid state plan policies in this area. As with waiting periods, we are seeking comments on an option to permit states to impose a 30-day lockout period. Next slide, please. And finally, we are proposing to remove annual and lifetime benefit limits in CHIP. Currently, annual and lifetime limits are prohibited only for behavioral health benefits provided through a separate CHIP due to the Mental Health Parity Act of 1996, or MAPIA. However, many states have already taken steps to remove limits on CHIP benefits, and no state currently has lifetime limits for CHIP benefits. We think that no longer having these types of limits will improve continued access to coverage, and this provision also aligns CHIP with Medicaid in the marketplace. In this case, the most notable change here will be around limitations for dental coverage. Next slide, please. And in the interest of time, we're going to skip this slide, and I'll transition it back to Shannon for slide 28.
Thanks, Emily. So the last objective that we wanted to discuss were proposals related to enhancing program integrity and providing states with consistent standards. So we propose to establish maximum timeframes for redeterminations of eligibility. The current regulations specify the timeframes in which a state must process applications. Renewals must be completed by the end of an individual's eligibility period. But we do not really define what it means to redetermine eligibility on a change in circumstance, and we know that there are oftentimes circumstances when an individual returns information late in a renewal period. So in the rule, we propose to establish specific time frames related to renewals and renovations based on changes in circumstances. We also ensure that these timeframes also account for when beneficiaries return requested information or documentation towards the end of the renewal or redetermination process. And we hope that these proposals will provide consistent standards that states can use to make sure that they are timely processing redeterminations. Next slide, please. And finally, we proposed to strengthen the record-keeping regulations in Medicaid and CHIP. So the current regulations on the maintenance of applicant and beneficiary case records are unclear and outdated, and we know that a lack of eligibility record information has been highlighted in federal and state audits, as well as other reviews. And to reduce vulnerabilities associated with the lack of documentation, we propose to modernize state record-keeping systems to require that records be stored in electronic formats, to make sure that we're delineating the type of records that must be retained as part of an applicant or beneficiary case record, as well as establish minimum record retention periods for these records. And next slide, please. And now I'll turn it back to Stephanie Bell.
Thank you. So there's so much good stuff in this NPRM, and we're also thinking about everything that's on your plates right now, and particularly looking forward to unwinding from the continuous enrollment condition following the public health emergency. We want your input on the appropriate timeline for implementing the provisions in this rule that become final, so we could make sure that the timeline allows states to move forward with some of these important protections and changes without negatively impacting the resumption of routine eligibility and enrollment operations. With that in mind, we're considering an effective date of 30 to 60 days after publication of a final rule. So not now, but when the final rule comes out, 30 to 60 days after publication, and then a separate date for compliance with the final requirements, or perhaps dates that vary by provision, but would be no more than 12 months following the effective date. Next slide. So public comments. Please submit public comments. The comment period is open through November 7, 2022, and we really do want your input, not only on the provisions themselves and the details, but also on the implementation. Next slide. Just re-echoing. Please take a look and submit your public comments. I think that's the end of our presentation, Jackie.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie and team, for your presentation today. We're now ready to take your questions. So we've started already receiving questions through the chat function, so we'll begin there, and then we'll move to the phone line. So I'll turn now to you, Ashley.
Thanks, Jackie. So the first question says, how long does CMS anticipate it will take to release a final rule after the November 7th, 2022 deadline for public comment?
This is Stephanie. I wish I had a crystal ball. I believe the intent is that sometime next year is when the final rule would be completed.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. We have a question that says, regarding allowing SSI clients automatic Quimby, can you address the SSI deemed eligible groups? DAC, PICLs, widower exclusion, et cetera, do they get automatic Quimby? We understand not all the exclusions that apply to Medicaid apply to MSP programs.
Hi, no, Melissa. Hi, Dizan, but this is Suzette Sanks. I think the way the rule is proposed, it is only the mandatory SSI group who is in receipt of SSI and receiving Medicaid on that basis in a 1634 state. Or I'm sorry, I'm not sure if that last part is right, but let me just say it is the base group of mandatory individuals receiving SSI.
Hi, this is Melissa Height, and I agree with what Suzette just said. It's focused on the SSI mandatory.
Okay, thank you both. The next question says, the slide 28, does the proposal to treat SAVE as standalone evidence of U.S. citizenship apply to VLPs as well?
Ashley, I'm sorry.
Somebody's about
to say something. Yeah, I was going to ask for the clarification also. What is to VLP?
Yes, that's what it says.
Jean, do you know what a VLP is? We made?
No, I do not. I do not.
Yeah, I think that's the Verify Lawful Presence Service through the hub.
So I think this is not going to. I think we maybe that's we're getting into the details of what the code returns are from the hub that maybe we should take offline. It applies not to necessarily to who's verified lawfully present, or it's allowing this, I guess, right now, we're down into the weeds of the code. I think we better not try and venture an answer to the question, but we can try and take it offline and get back to the questioner.
Okay, thanks, Sarah. Then we have a question that says, regarding the 12-month eligibility period for non-MAGI determinations, it's clear that this applies to financial eligibility. How would the 12-month continuous eligibility period interface with states that require functional eligibility determinations more frequently than 12 months? This would specifically apply to the special income group.
Hi, this is Shannon, and I can start to clarify that the rule proposes to ensure that all beneficiaries have their coverage renewed once and only once every 12 months. It does not include a proposal for continuous eligibility. I believe that, the renewal process is, a little bit different than maybe some of the level of care potential determinations that maybe the questioner might be referring to.
Or Shannon, this is Gene. I think the question may be with regard to that unique eligibility group that serves people who are actually in a medical institution. If they, for any such individual, being in an institutional or in a medical institution is a fundamental requirement for eligibility in that group. If they leave the institution, that's a change in circumstance. In light of a fundamental eligibility-related requirement, changing in its circumstance, there would be the requirement that a redetermination be made of the individual.
Thank you, Jean. I think at this point we'll move over to the phone lines to see if we have questions there. So, operator, could you please provide instructions for how the applicants or the participants can register their calls, and then we'll see if we can take some calls there.
Then,
yes, ma'am.
Jackie, before we end, I'd like to just say a word.
Sure. Would you like to go ahead and do that now, Anne-Marie?
No, you take the calls.
Okay. Operator, I'll turn to you.
Yes, ma'am. If you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press star followed by one. Please make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name clearly when prompted. If you wish to withdraw your question, you can press star two. Please allow a moment for questions to come in. Thank you. Our first question comes from Will. Your line is open, but he just took himself out of the queue.
Do we have any other questions?
No other questions at this time, ma'am.
Okay. Anne-Marie, I'll turn to you, and then we'll do our close out.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you to the team for presenting. I just wanted to remind everyone on today's call that the information that our team just presented is related to notice of proposed rulemaking, and we encourage you to review the rule and to have your state provide comments to the rule. The best way to understand the impact of the provisions we are proposing is to receive comments from you all, both on the policy and the operational aspects of the rule. So So again, please, we ask that you appreciate your efforts to take the time to review the rule and submit comments to us. So Jackie, thank you.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. And we still do have a number of questions so that we won't be able to get responses to those. But we do want to thank the team for their presentations today and thank all of you for your questions. We also want to also make you aware that we will have a call next Tuesday, September the 20th. From 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so another call next week. If you do have questions before that call, you can reach out to us, your state leads, or you can bring your questions to that call. So we thank you again for joining us today, and we'll be speaking with you next week. Have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time, and thank you for joining.